Coming up next is the show you've been waiting for, Black Op Radio. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network. Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. To call in, we have a secure line ready. Area code 604-525-4167. Again, just call area code 604-525-4167. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. And now your hosts, Anita Langley and Leno Sanner.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Black Op Radio. It is October 16th, 2003, and this is number 145. You're joined today by Leno Sanick and Anita Langley here in the studio. Hi, Len.
Hello, Anita.
And we also have online Mr. Jim Rary. Are you there?
Yes.
Great. Well, we were going to have Mr. Cyril Wecht on tonight for those who saw the posting, but there is this breaking news going down with Dr. David Kelly and what's going on there, so things worked out this way. It's great.
And Cyril will be on next week.
Yes, for those who'd like to know. First of all, though, before we get into your article, which is quite astounding to many people, I'm sure, and maybe not quite so surprising to a few others, would you mind giving us a little bit of background about yourself? Let us know how you came to be writing this type of article and a little bit just more about you.
Sure. Back in the 60s, a couple of friends of mine bought a newspaper, and for about 3 years, I was editor and investigative reporter on it in the Los Angeles area, about 40,000 circulation. At the end of that time, I went back into my career of finance, and I retired from a Fortune 100 company after spending about 6 years being responsible for complying with all of the U.S. import and export regulations in 106 countries that we operated in. I spent quite a bit of time traveling around talking to government officials in Washington and in other countries. After I retired, I took it easy for a year or two, and then I started writing articles to really commentaries to some of my friends. And as word got around, people started asking me to send them a copy. So finally, I put a tag down at the end saying, if they wanted their articles, that they could contact me, and I would put them on my list. That has grown so that I have a number of what I call subscribers, although it's free, in each of the 50 states and 39 foreign countries. And there are at least a dozen websites that post some of my articles. There are a couple that post all of them, and one of them even archives them for me. I don't have a website myself. So that's about where we are now.
Okay, so now how did you get to be so well informed about the topic of Dr. David Kelly?
Well, it takes a lot of research, because I have quite a few contacts around not just the United States, but various countries. I do get some tips, some of which pan out and some don't.
Okay.
But mainly it's research, and most of it's on the web.
Right, all right. So where Dr.
On this particular article, almost all of it comes from the hearing transcripts from the so-called inquiry.
The Hutton inquiry.
The Hutton inquiry, right.
Okay, well, what would you like to tell us then, if you don't mind going through some of these points that you've mentioned in your article, the things that have been brought to the attention of the Hutton inquiry, and perhaps maybe speculate a little bit as to why some of these things aren't making it into the mainstream media?
Okay, well, first of all, let me preface this by saying this is probably one of the clumsiest government cover-ups I've seen. And to answer your second question ahead here, why isn't it in the media? Because the media is controlled. I assume you have a fairly well-versed audience, and I won't have to explain to them what the Council on Foreign Relations is, or its sister organization, the Royal Institute of International Affairs over in the U.K., but they basically control the national news media in each of those countries. And the big play that's getting in the media is all political. It's about, who said what about the dossier, and did they fudge it a little bit to try to get backing for attacking Iraq. And I don't really believe that that had much to do with it, with the murder of Dr. Kelly, which we can go into a little bit as to what he knew and why he was so dangerous to them.
Yeah, I find that very interesting. Why don't you elaborate on just why some people found him dangerous?
As far as the murder itself, Dr. Kelly was in the habit of going out for afternoon walks almost daily. And on Thursday, July 17th, he left for his usual walk and didn't come back. His wife, of course, got worried around 5, 6 o'clock. She called her daughter over and some friends and so on, and they were looking in the vicinity for him with no luck, but they didn't notify the police until after 11 o'clock at night that they had a missing person on their hands. At that time, they started searching around the vicinity of the house within a mile or so. They had an Air Force helicopter up, and they had some dogs from the nearby Air Force base out searching that area, but they didn't really get organized to search any further than that until the following morning. There's an organization of volunteers that do search and rescue, so a couple of them, along with a search dog, were assigned an area that Dr. Kelly was known to often go to on his walks, and so they went over to that area with their search dog, whose name was Brock, searched two or three parts of the area they'd been assigned to, and then virtually the last area that they went to, which was a sort of a narrow lane back into a woods with some rather heavy underbrush on either side of it. And the dog was running, going quite a bit ahead of the handler and her companion. So when it came back and indicated that it had found something, she indicated, okay, well, take me to it. And the dog didn't. He just laid down, contrary to his training, because he's trained to come back and indicate that he's found something and then lead her to it. So anyway, she went off in the direction that he had come from, and he didn't even follow her. He just laid there. So she went around a little bend there, and she saw the body propped up against a tree. So she called her companion, who was lagging a little bit behind, and he took a look, and then he, on his cell phone, called police headquarters and reported that they had found the body. As they were leaving the scene to go back to their car, where they had parked some distance away, they met three police officers. One of them later found out was a Detective Constable Coe, C-O-E, Coe. And so they left them in charge of the scene there where the body was, and went on their way back to police headquarters to give their statements. In the meantime, the police had been organizing to conduct a search, including that area, but in other areas too. This, incidentally, they found the body around 9 a.m. on the morning of Friday the 18th. And that was about the time that the search party, one of the search parties, was getting ready to leave the police station to go out to that area. And when the call came in that the body had been found, of course, that was that's where they went, and all the other search parties were more or less canceled. But when they got there, the body was flat on its back. It wasn't propped up against a tree.
That's odd right away.
Yeah, both the two constables had testified to that. The two searchers, volunteers, testified that the body was propped up against the tree. And it makes sense that someone had to change the position of the body, because the medical evidence was that, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with what livor mortis is. It's sometimes called also post-mortem lividity. Basically what that is, that after you're dying, your heart stops pumping. The force of gravity brings the blood down to the lowest level of the body. So if you're lying on your stomach when you die, the blood will settle to your stomach, or on your back, it will settle to your back. And that gives a definite color to the part of the body. That's what they call lividity. And the medical testimony was that he died, or either was put on his back, flat on his back, shortly after he died. So that was really the first clue that something was really wrong. The next bit was really in the medical testimony about the wrist that had been slit. There were four or five minor cuts, even a couple of them only scratches, and just one really deep cut. And medically speaking, you have two arteries that go through your wrist. One is called the ulnar artery, and that's the one that goes into the little finger. Then you have the radial artery, which is the more prominent one that goes into the thumb and the rest of the hand. And if you've done any first aid, you know that radial artery is the one that you put your fingers on to check the pulse. Well, that wasn't severed, but the ulnar was. Now, if you just stick your left arm out there and pretend you're drawing a knife across your wrist, it'd be very difficult to sever that ulnar artery, which is hard to reach in the first place, and it's much deeper in the flesh and behind some cartilage, as opposed to the radial artery. Now, the forensic pathologist did not testify as to which direction the knife had gone across his wrist. A reasonably competent medical examiner or pathologist could tell you that, and would tell you that in an autopsy report. There is an autopsy report, but it's not going to be made public. And neither is the toxicology report. The medical examiner, the toxicologist, and they also had a forensic biologist who visited the scene to look at things like blood spattering on vegetation and whether anything was trampled down with anyone else in the area and so on. All three of them were from a private company called Forensic Alliance. Looking at its board of directors, it's a little bit suspect, but most of its business is done with police organizations. So, I don't know, maybe they get the results they want, but I think the pathologist that did the autopsy probably had to play it pretty straight, because there was going to be the coroner would be holding a review, and he would have had the authority to order either a review of the autopsy or even a new one if there was any doubt about the medical evidence. And he didn't know at the time, of course, that he was performing the autopsy that there was going to be this Lord Hutton inquiry, which preempted the proceedings and took it away from the coroner. So they never really concluded that. There's been some talk about after Hutton issues his report, he might resume, but I'm not holding my breath on that.
Where does the family stand in this? Do they get a full list of the things that have gone on here? I mean, if they opt to make things public, do they have that option?
Well, on the Hutton website, the Hutton Inquiry website, the hearing depositions of those who are testified at the public hearings, and then there's a list of evidence, most of which will not be released to the public. It's really strange. One of the strange things is that the police interviewed over 300 witnesses. For some reason, they said that they were not going to release those, even to the inquiry, unless the witness signed an authorization releasing their statement.
That's crazy. I mean, that really is. That's new.
Well, they only sent about 70 witness statements over to the inquiry, and they admitted that they had withheld some that they did not feel were relevant to the inquiry. And there's a list of those, but that list is not going to be released either. So, you know, we have no way of knowing whether what they told the police is the same thing that they testified to in public. And the witnesses were not under oath, which is the same thing they're pulling in this 911 investigation in Washington. Nobody is being required to testify under oath there either.
That basically makes everybody's statements less legitimate, doesn't it, in the end? If somebody was to call to task somebody else because of a statement made, well, it wasn't a statement under oath, it's just general information. I guess to me that seems like a reason to do that. I can't think of another reason offhand.
Now, how could you take testimony and not impose the person to tell the truth?
Well, of course, you can't be prosecuted for perjury if you weren't under oath.
Well, of course, yes, there's that. That is strange, but, yeah. Now, where does the family stand in all this? Are they I know that there were some noises made early on. It sounded like there were some suspicions there. Do you get the sense that there's a demand within the family to get to the bottom of this in a real serious way?
Well, I think the Janice Kelly, the widow, sort of clammed up in a hurry. And I suspect it probably had something to do with survivor's benefits on Kelly's pension, which was controlled by, or would be controlled by, the Ministry of Defense. You know, and you can imagine, like in this country, if you start spilling some beans about the Defense Department and they controlled your pension, lots of luck.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
The daughter, Rachel, seemed a little more outspoken. One of the things that got a big play both in England and here was this statement that David Boucher, I guess maybe it's pronounced, who's in the UK Foreign Office, said that, oh yeah, well after the so-called suicide, because he didn't say so-called, but the suicide, he remembered that, gee, back in February when he met Dr. Kelly in Geneva, and they were discussing the what's come to be called the dossier over there in England. That's the white paper that Tony Blair put out that justified attacking Iraq. And there's been a political controversy over whether they fudged a little bit about exactly how dangerous the weapons were that Saddam had. But Ms. Boucher said, oh yeah, I remember that right at the tail end of that conversation, Dr. Kelly sort of a tough away line said, you know, if we do attack Iraq, I may be found dead in the woods. And that was really played up in this country, in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a light statement to make. I mean, one might argue that, oh, he might have known ahead of time that he would feel suicidal, but then he would have had a history of depression if that was the case.
The problem with that is that when his daughter Rachel testified, she said that she had gone back and checked her father's diaries, and the only time that he was in Geneva was in February of 2002, not this year.
So,
and that was the only time he had ever met Boucher. Now, the proof that he's lying there is that the dossier, there wasn't even a draft of the dossier at that time in February 2002. But yet, Boucher said that he discussed the dossier with Kelly. So, early on, they're, spinning that that's got to be a suicide.
Yeah, weird. On the other hand, one might have taken something like that to mean that the guy was sort of tongue-in-cheek that somebody would off him if that was the case. So, I don't know, that kind of a comment could backfire. And actually, after what you just said, really could backfire if that sort of information was made a little more public to go with the comment.
Yeah, well, to continue with the clumsiness of this cover-up, when this Detective Constable Cole, met the volunteers and the other constables that showed up and so on, he had two police officers with him. At least they were dressed like police officers. But yet, when Cole testified, he said, no, there was only one with me. It was just me and Constable Shields. Well, you know, five witnesses had testified that there were two people with him. Now, to complicate things, when the nominal head of the investigation, Assistant Chief Constable Michael Page, testified, he said that they had gotten a phone call from a gentleman who also had communicated with the inquiry, saying that between 8:30 and 9:30 on the 18th a.m. on the morning of the 18th, that was the morning that the body was found, that he had seen three men who appeared to be police officers in dark or black clothing in that area, and they were acting suspiciously. Well, Page, Lord Hutton asked him, well, you know, did you investigate that? And he says, oh, yes, we took statements from about 50 officers, and we did a lot of triangulation and everything, and I'm satisfied that that we know who those men were. Well, they weren't police officers because no search parties had been set out, except the ones that went directly at about 9:30, which was outside the time frame of when this guy reported them. So there's another, that's a sort of a mystery there, as to who are these men in dark clothing, along with who is the third man that was with Cole. The only reason I can think of that Cole would go against the testimony of five separate witnesses would be because the presence of that third man could not really be satisfactorily explained. Or if it was explained, that it would spill some beans. So that was kind of a mystery, even as far as conjecture is concerned, until I ran across this thing in the list of evidence about the tactical support that the Thames Valley Police had provided someone or some organization, starting at 2:30 p.m. on the 17th, which is about an hour before Kelly left his house on his walk, and a full 8 hours before he was reported missing. And then it ended at 9:30 a.m. the next day, which is about the time that D.C. Cole and his one or two companions left the scene. And the name that they gave to the support activity that they were giving was Operation Mason, which...
That doesn't inspire confidence in the whole thing.
Well, it almost seems like an in-your-face kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
No, just to taunt the people that are aware of the Masonic influence and so on. There was an interesting article in the British press last week about 5,000 Masons met in London for some kind of a conference. One of the issues they discussed there was that someone in the government was trying to force government employees, including police organizations, to disclose whether or not they were members of a Masonic order. And 85% to 90% of the police were refusing.
That's not the first time, is it? I mean, these purges have gone on fairly regularly. I understand that there was a big scandal around Scotland Yard some years ago, little symbols being written on the corners of test pages and stuff, and people were getting free passes into seats that they hadn't earned. And it does make you wonder, some of these little clubs, how much this goes on.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, there was something going on about the same time that Kelly went missing for a number of hours and turned up dead. Of course, we don't know what it was, and they're not about to tell us. But I think that was another mistake. This clumsiness that I was talking about was even including the description of that document in the list of evidence. It certainly triggers a lot of questions. What kind of tactical support and to whom were they giving it?
Yeah, and it gives you a place to go from to actually do the research and come up with some names, which so just the clumsiness alone makes a person wonder how premeditated this was, or if it was a snap decision, or if it was just bad orchestration.
Well, yeah, you never know. Maybe somebody just on the inside is trying to give us a tip that something is wrong. Or maybe it's just sheer incompetence. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if there's comfort in either response, because incompetence could have a lot of bad repercussions, considering the level of the playing field that's being, you know, these exercises are going on. You're talking wars with other nations and invading people. And unfortunately, I do tend to lean in that direction, because it looks to me like just incompetence, left, right, and center. And I just don't understand how some of these disasters could come to pass intentionally. It just doesn't. I don't see, for example, Bush and Blair having the foresight to see the aftermath of what they did in Iraq until it actually happened. I mean, Blair, he's really in the hot seat over this, and hopefully Bush and Cheney are going to be, you know, following him down the pipes for that.
Well, you know, we got two parallel things going on here. We got the outing of Plume, Wilson's wife, the CIA agent.
Oh, yeah, that was something else.
Which you know, putting almost as much pressure on Bush as this Dr. Kelly thing is on Blair. And I don't think it's a coincidence.
No, it's a dirty tricks department.
Right. The Kelly was involved in a lot of things that the public was really not aware of. First of all, some of his associates, evidently two of the people that he corresponded with by email, basically, quite often. One of them was Judith Miller, the longtime CFR member who's a Pulitzer Prize winner on the New York Times. And the other one was a British lady by the name of Olivia Bosch, who was a member of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which, of course, is the CFR counterpart in the UK. And she even got Kelly to join the IRIIA about a year before his death. I haven't seen that anywhere in the media, although we come out in her testimony after the hearing, at the inquiry. Another one is Mai Petersen. This is a classic Mata Hari. She's a U.S. intelligence asset agent and a linguist, and she met Kelly over in Iraq, where she was, her cover was the translator. And she got very close to him. In fact, she converted him to the Baha'i faith, much to the astonishment of his wife. And I guess this gal is a real raving beauty and a flirt de boot, according to her ex-husband. So it's a little bit easier to see how maybe she may have influenced Kelly. But it seems strange that the three major influences, or at least the ones that communicated with the most, were women. And women who are placed there for specific purposes. Kelly, for about 8 years, was the chief microbiologist at Porton Down, which still is really the premier center for research and development of not only vaccines, but weapons, weaponized diseases. And during the time, at least part of the time that he was there, we know from trials that were held down in South Africa. I don't know if you're familiar with the name of Wouter Bashan.
No, I'm not.
Who ran what was called Project Coast, which was the, under the apartheid government, was the program to develop genetic weapons that could be used against groups with specific DNA characteristics, for instance, blacks. And they did develop some things that would affect blacks and not whites. And so during the testimony in that trial, it came out that there were two scientists from Porton Down who were on the were paid consultants to that Project Coast program. Their names were never made public, so don't know if Kelly was one of them, but certainly it seems likely that he would have known who those two were. Kelly was also involved when the head of the Soviet Union's bioweapon program defected to the UK. Pesheshnik is his name. Kelly, along with a fellow by the name of Davis and a couple of others, debriefed him, and he was immediately given a job at Porton Down. As a result of what he told the intelligence agencies about what the Soviet Union was doing in developing bioweapons, there was an agreement with the Russian government. This was Brezhnev defected before the USSR broke up, because in 1989, and the number two man in that program, whose Americanized name is Ken Alabeck, defended or defected shortly after the USSR broke up. But before that happened, Kelly and Davis and several others, a couple from the United States, went over and made a secret inspection of the Russian facilities for buildings called Biopreparat, where their bioweapon programs were going on. And then in return, and then Ken Alabeck, who was then, I guess, the number one man in the program because Cessnick had defected, was their host in showing them around. There was a reciprocal visit where Alabeck came over and brought some Russian scientists, and they supposedly inspected the American bio facilities. They took them down to Pine Bluffs, Arkansas, to a facility down there which years earlier had been involved in the program, but everything was obsolete there and had been basically closed down, and they just had a few things stored there. So the real research and development was being done at Fort Detrick in Maryland, and the Dugaway Army complex in Utah, and had a couple of foundations, Battelle Memorial and the one controlled by James Baker, the Secretary of State, and other positions in the government. But Alabeck never saw them, supposedly. So he went back to the Soviet Union and says, well, gee, we better stop our program because the U.S. stopped theirs years ago. And then he defected, was immediately hired by Battelle, one of those two involved in the program. And he became an advisor to the CIA, and he's now been set up with his own subsidiary, or his own company, which is a subsidiary of Hadron, a defense contractor. I don't know if that rings a bell with your listeners, but Hadron is the company that peddled the Promise software.
I was just going to say, I didn't even know that company was still running. I thought that they would have been shut down. I'm more than a little surprised.
I don't think we have time to go into the Promise software thing because that has all kinds of ramifications, even leading you into BCCI. But
You don't know this actually, but our listeners do. Michael Reconagiuto is a member of my family, and I've actually discussed his case somewhat on this program on occasion. So Promise is a very interesting and sort of a daily issue for me.
Yeah, well, that would take at least one program to try to cover that in any depth at all.
Yeah, but back to Hadron and what you're mentioning here, rather than distract so far.
One of the others, this Davis, that accompanied them on the inspection tour over in the Soviet Union and also helped debrief Pachesnik, came out of British defense intelligence establishment. But at the time of the trips, he was an employee of Viridian, Calspan Corporation. And that has an interesting history, too, because it started out as a separate lab funded by the CIA to do mind control research, where Gottlieb and Louis Julian and a couple other Nazi scientists that had been brought over were doing experiments. And then while it was still it was taken over by Calspan, or changed its name to Calspan. And before Viridian acquired it, about the time Timothy McVeigh was discharged from the service, he got a job with an international security organization. And his assignment was to help guard the premises of Calspan, where all this mind control research was going on. And of course, McVeigh had told everyone that he had been implanted with a chip during the first Gulf War back in 1991. And we now know that, of course, a number of GIs were, the rationale being that it'd be easier to find them in case they got captured or lost or whatever. But that's a real interesting coincidence.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff around what happened with McVeigh that is pretty foggy.
So Viridian then acquired Calspan, became Viridian Calspan, which just in August of this year was acquired by General Dynamics. So now it's in a part of one of the largest defense contractors. So Davis, Alabac, Chesnick died very strangely in 2002. His death wasn't announced by anyone where he was working. It was announced by Davis, this Viridian employee. Supposedly he died of a stroke, but there was no autopsy or anything like that, or inquest. And that's the word I was searching for on the Kelly thing. The inquest that the coroner was holding was preempted by the Hutton inquiry. So now, since 9-1-1 attacks there, we've had worldwide probably 30 top microbiologists that have died, most of them under very mysterious circumstances, some of them outright murder.
30. I thought it was about 12 or 15.
Kelly, of course, is one of the worldwide, world-class microbiologists. And he not only had experience, hands-on experience at Porton Down, but he knew a lot of the secrets of the, what's now the Russian government, South Africa, even Israel. He's, according to one journalist, he was working with the Israeli bioweapon program.
Now, do you think that certain powers that be thought that he might crack if the media came down on him? Why would they find it necessary to take
him
out over this?
That's the story they're trying to promulgate, that he got caught in a minor lie and that he was so depressed over his loss of honor and so on that he went out and killed himself. Yeah, that's a bunch of malarkey, because this guy was...
That's not the kind of cracking that I was thinking about. I was sort of wondering if maybe, I mean, you mentioned a lot of stuff that's very sensitive. For his name to be made public and have the media come around him, do you think these topics that he was involved with would necessarily be aired? I mean, there are a lot of people who've been involved in things that might be questionable, but you don't get to find out about it. So I guess I'm asking, why do you think that he was such a threat that he had to be killed?
Okay.
Aside from the fact that all these other microbiologists have taken over.
Good reason for it. Because he had been involved in this stuff for years and had most of this knowledge for years without leaking it or anything, and that really gave him no reason to doubt his reliability. But what happened to him the last 3 years by the Ministry of Defense Personnel Department really made him angry. He went 3 years without a raise in pay. And one time he was promised they were going to reorganize and reclassify him to a much higher classification with a higher salary. And he was getting close to retirement age, and your salary has a determination on what your retirement pay is. And one of the retired defense intelligence analysis directors, when he testified, evidently he kept in contact with Kelly and was probably pretty good friends with him. And just Kelly was very upset about this, that he felt he was being slighted as far as what he was contributing, and that they were just, you know, basically jerking him around. And Lord Hutton asked him, well, not Lord Hutton, being one of the attorneys that was examining witnesses, asked him, he says, well, do you seem vengeful about it or what? And the witness said, well, not quite. Yeah, he was very upset about it. So I would think that the normal reaction to being treated like that is not one of depression and suicide. It's one of anger.
Yeah, righteousness and anger. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so
and
keeping
maybe
that...
maybe looking for a way to revenge.
Yeah, now keeping that in mind, perhaps it's possible that certain superiors knew that he wasn't very happy and maybe he might spill the beans about something if the camera came on him.
Yeah.
But still,
I get the impression he was the type that that wouldn't really gripe, except to maybe someone like one of his fellow workers there, or someone who was retired. He obviously didn't share it with his wife, but she sensed that something was wrong.
Okay, so there must be a motive somewhere beyond. I mean, if we look at the issue of this business being made public, do you think by taking him out of the loop that maybe it was possible to, if things had gone quote unquote right?
I'm sorry, I missed that last part. Do I think what?
That if by taking him out of the loop, by removing him as somebody who could be a centerpiece for the media, maybe somebody might have been hoping this issue would go away, this issue of his having stated prior to the invasion that there were no problems with weapons of mass destruction.
Well, as I alluded to near the start of the program about the parallel problems that Bush is having here, that I don't think is a coincidence. From the actions of those I know to be taking their direction from the elite and the CFR and the RIIA over in the UK, it appears to me that what they're going to do is they're going to push out Blair and Bush and replace them with people who will basically carry on the same programs, but with a new rationale, and it'll take the public a long time to catch on to them.
Mm-hmm.
So probably the crowning, or the straw that they figured may have broken Kelly's back, the proverbial camel's back, which seemed to be deliberate. He had appeared before the Joint Intelligence Committee to answer some questions, but then they asked him to appear for a private grilling, and the person that they assigned to it to do the grilling was the personnel director for the Defense Ministry, the very one who had been screwing him around for 3 years.
Right. Well, that adds some interesting dimensions. As obviously there were some conflicts and stuff going on at different levels there. Still, each one taken on its own doesn't seem like a real motive for murder, but if you're trying to unseat a government, create a scandal, who knows what's in them. I guess I'm not really satisfied as to what the rationale was behind it, because it seems to me that if they trusted him in with all this other secret stuff, that they could have trusted him to ride out this little bit of a publicity storm. So there must have been something else. I mean, just being disgruntled doesn't seem to... Could he have been that badly disgruntled?
Well, no, I think it's all the knowledge he had. And bear in mind that if he was predisposed to become a whistleblower...
Yeah, I guess that's the biggest question.
It's not just the UK government that had to worry. It's the U.S. government, the Russian government, perhaps the Israeli government. South Africa probably not, because those people have been thrown out of power. But, at least four governments who... If they thought Kelly was, weakening and was unreliable, that they would not like to see him around.
So that's really what it comes down to, I think, also in my mind, because it's more about general whistleblowing than the subject of what happened with Iraq.
Oh yes,
because everybody's.
That's definitely my opinion that.
Because that's been the big question for me, like, why would that be enough to get him killed? But what you're saying about the things he knew, that puts a whole different dimension into this thing, and it actually does provide a real motive.
Exactly.
To have him eliminated. The timing is terrible. You'd think that they might have, well, I guess, though, if this thing had picked up, there wouldn't have been the opportunity to take him out.
Well, I don't know that the timing is that bad, because if my assumption is correct, my reading of the situation, and they want Blair out of there,
What
could have been more damaging?
Yeah, you're right about that, because it does make him look guilty more than... Because, I mean, on British soil, nobody's going to look at somebody other than the British, members of the British government for causing this to happen, I guess, because this was an issue among their people to the public concern. And what you're talking about isn't even public knowledge, so nobody would be even looking anywhere else. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, it is an effective way to bring down Blair. Although I would think that the people were just mad enough anyways that he was probably going to go down without...
Well, my sources over in the UK say that probably a large percentage of the UK public don't believe the suicide story. They think he was bumped off. But they think it was over the Iraqi dossier.
Yeah, I mean, because that is the natural conclusion to come to, but it still leaves a person scratching their head, because... the logic says, well, the story, the cat was already out of the bag. What was he going to add to it, you know? But yes, what you said has shed a lot of light on the situation, for me anyways, and I'm grateful to have that extra understanding, because it's been bugging me for a while, I'll say, and I'm sure, like I said, I had my suspicions right from the start, and I'm sure, for me, being a little on the suspicious side anyways, that's not surprising, but it still doesn't surprise me that so many of the British people are questioning this. It just, the whole thing stank right from the word go.
Right. And as I said, it's very clumsy, and maybe purposely so.
That's interesting to think that it might be purposely clumsy. I don't usually consider it that way. Yeah, these governments are so used to setting in motion cover-ups and stuff like that. But, yeah, you never know how clever somebody might be in that regard. So what do you think is going to happen now? You think it's going to take a long time for this thing to continue to unfold, or is it going to pick up momentum?
Well, Lord Hutton has come out the last couple of days and said, at first he was saying, well, you know, I might have the final report out for you in November or December. Now he's saying, well, no, it won't come out till next year because I've got a lot of evidence to wade through and so on and so on. And Parliament is setting up a procedure where they will debate it once the final report comes out. Well, by that time, we could be into two more wars.
And by that time, no matter what the version of the final report, it might not make that big of a difference anymore. But I do have to wonder if it's possible that the Hutton Inquiry, in light of the things that are being unearthed, might just in the end say, hey, this was a murder. Do you think there's any indication that it might go
away? Well, that's entirely possible. I got an email from one of the government propagandists, an author that some of you may be familiar with, Gordon Thomas, saying that he read my part one with great interest and was very much interested in seeing part two, when I please make sure that it was sent directly to him. There's another journalist who is an obvious intelligence asset, and that's Tom Mangold. I don't know if you're familiar with that name. But in the UK, he's been set up as the expert journalist on weapons of mass destruction, much as Judith Miller has here in the United States. And back in 1998, he co-wrote a script for a PBS Frontline special called The Plague War. I don't know if any of you remember that.
I don't recall that one.
Yeah, and it was later turned into a book of the same name. But the theme of that was, and they brought in all kinds of people with either film clips or live interviews, Kelly being one of them, Davis another one, Albeck another one, James Baker another one, all of the usual suspects, I guess you'd say. And the theme of the program was that when the United States, Russia, and the UK signed in 1972, signed the treaty banning production or research and development in weapons of mass destruction, that the United States, actually, President Nixon had said we were going to stop it before the treaty was signed. And the theme was that, well, yes, the UK and the United States did stop, but the Russia didn't. They cheated. And that's what the inspection tours were all about and so on. And Mangold was one of the first journalists, hours after the news of Kelly's death came out, portraying himself as one of Kelly's best friends. And, oh, my goodness, you know, it's so sorry and sorrowful that he felt his honor had been so compromised that he had to do away with himself and so on. Well, it turns out he was no best friend of Kelly. He had very limited contact with him. He probably first met him when he was doing that so-called documentary for Frontline in 1998, and he'd only had contact with him by email three or four times since then. But he portrayed himself as his best friend, and then he came out later with an article about, well, gee, maybe the last phone call that Kelly got about a half an hour before he left the house was telling him that one of the BBC reporters had a tape recording that proved he was lying, and that was the final blow to his honor and integrity, so he went out and killed himself. Especially in the UK, the propaganda has been really heavy pushing the suicide thing. But at the same time, if anyone is paying attention to the inquiry itself, even though they weren't asking really tough questions and there was really absolutely no cross-examination, even when there were glaring inconsistencies between witnesses, like Cole saying he only had one man with them and five other witnesses saying there were two, so on. He was never asked about that. In fact, he was originally scheduled to testify early on, but they, for some reason, wasn't called until after all of the other witnesses that had been physically at the scene had testified. Then they brought him in so that no one would come after him to contradict him. And I guess they have faith that there aren't too many of us that will look at all the details and will believe what we see and hear in the media.
Gee, by now there shouldn't be that much faith considering the state of the Internet and how many independent news publications are cropping up all over the place.
Well, it's becoming more difficult for them, yes.
Been a bit of a landslide the last 10, 12 years as far as people having the ability to start to take control of how well-informed they are. And it really helps that a person can turn on their computer and have somebody forward them an article, like I had forwarded to me, your article, and I didn't have to go look for it. Somebody thought it was important enough that I have it. And that's great, because that's how we become informed, really. We're informing each other, and we never had this opportunity before. And I think that government is so slow to catch up, and all these types of details that you're talking about, maybe they really are supposed to come out. Maybe this is just sloppiness. Yeah, one way or another, it's great that you're able to put it on the record like this. And
I don't think it's sloppy, though. I think things are done on purpose.
You think things are done on purpose? You never know. I mean, everybody's an individual. Some people have a bad hair day.
Sometimes we give them credit for being a little more clever than they are.
Yeah, you never know. But actually, sometimes we might underrate, underestimate our danger.
Yeah, probably more often. More often underrated than they are overrated.
Yeah.
But they are human and they do make mistakes.
Well, we're coming up on
it. Usually they're able to cover them up.
Though. Yeah. Well, that's been traditionally the way, but I think more and more people are paying close attention whenever something suspicious happens and jumping on the ball. I'd say that there are more. They talk about how many terrorists are created by an unwarranted attack. Well, I think there are more righteous people created by an unwarranted attack than anything else. And you look at the number of people out there doing their best, their level best to try and inform each other and just, you know, picking up a typewriter or a keyboard, I guess, these days, and setting up web pages and, I mean, things you never would have imagined. I never would have imagined 10, 15 years ago. So it's quite inspiring. And I think despite all this, I still feel fortunate to be alive.
Well,
right now.
It's a race of time, I guess, to can we wake enough people up before they get total control?
Yeah, well, I guess I have to have a certain amount of faith that that's what this is all about anyways and that we will succeed, I hope. But people like you are helping. And is there anything that you'd like to throw into this that we haven't really covered? We're coming up, we've had an hour here and don't really want to keep you too much longer if it's getting a little
late.
Well,
I would encourage those who don't mind doing tedious research to just plug into the Hutton Inquiry website and look at some of the testimony.
And also, for those who haven't seen...
I tried to check, you know, almost everything that was in my article came straight out of the hearing transcripts.
Okay.
Some of it was paraphrased, but it's all found there on the website.
For those who are looking...
I did that deliberately so that they, at least initially, could not attack me for... you know, as being making things up or wild-eyed conspiracy theorist or whatever. All I was doing was stating the facts and asking questions.
Okay. I want to let our listeners know where they can find your article right now. You mentioned that there are a few websites. I really know of the one that would be Mike Rupert's website from the wilderness at copvcia.com.
Yes, Mike Rupert... he gets all my articles. He only publishes a few of them, but he, when he got that, he emailed me and he basically said, "Boy," he says, "I was hoping somebody would take this on."
Yeah, I know it's been a while, so I'm really glad you did too. It's
yeah, and he decided to put it on his website as what he calls a freebie. Most of his really good articles, you have to be a paid subscriber before you can get in to see them.
Well, I'm glad he put it up as a freebie, and I think people need to see this, so very glad that he did that.
But you can do a Google search on the title or on my name and probably find it very quickly. In fact, last time I did a Google on it, my article was the first hit.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Now, you've got part two coming out in a few days.
Yeah, I hope to get it out, let's see, we're on Thursday now, so over the weekend for sure.
Great. Well, I'll be looking forward to that.
Yeah, and I'm sure Mike will put it up for one, so.
Well, we'll make a link to that on our website.
Quite frankly,
the article.
I've been flooded with requests, not only for subscriptions to my articles, but specifically saying, gee, can't wait for part two.
Okay, great.
Jim,
okay, nice talking to you.
Yeah, Jim, thanks a lot for joining us tonight. It's been great having you here, short notice, but thanks a lot, and we're looking forward to talking to you again. You come up with any more great research like this. So
okay, well,
let's keep in touch.
I'll put you on, I read on a variety of subjects.
Okay.
I'll put you on my list for my articles, and you can either delete them or do whatever you want to with them.
I won't be deleting them, but well, thanks again for joining us tonight.
Yeah. Thanks very much for being a guest, and we look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.